So I wonder if you can just say who you are and where we are.
Right, I'm Martin Morgan, and I'm secretary at the Black Rock Lavenet Fishermen's Association, an association of traditional salmon fishermen founded by my great-grandfather, William Corbin, on his return from the First World War.
Now, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's... you did. It was, they fished before that, but when they returned from the First World War...
Can I ask you to just move a bit closer, Martin?
Sorry? Yeah.
Just so, that, yeah. So I'm sure it picks it all up.
When he returned from the First World War, they fished prior to going off to the war. He was one of four brothers that from Chepstow that went to war. And he grew up in Chepstow. His nickname was Nestor because he climbed the cliffs of Chepstow, the Chepstow Y, collecting seagull's eggs for food. And that was his nickname. And his party trick was to jump off the railway, dive actually, off the railway bridge in, that goes across the Y.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, but that was when he was a young boy. I mean,
fantastic story.
When they returned from the war, they found that the fishery had been let by the Y board, I think it was at the time, on the fishery, to a guy from Gloucester, a merchant from Gloucester called Purcell, Mr. Purcell. And there's records of this in the Newport Museum, I think, or the records office. When they returned, it had been let by the Y board to this Purcell fella, and he said to them, you can fish in the fishery, but you've got to sell the fish to me at my price. So they, obviously they weren't going to have that. And they there's records of a little bit of a fight. They wrote to, you know, their MP in the day and the sort of powers that be. And it's unclear what happened, but shortly afterwards they obtained a lease of such from so they got the fishery back.
What year was this?
This would have been around about 1920.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I've got a copy of the actual first lease of the fishery. From that day forward, the people from Sudbrook, Portskewick, Caldicot fished on what was the ancient name was the Gruggy Rocks fishery, and that was our local fishery. So every year up until we were stopped in 2007 or 8, I can't remember which now, and they refused to, it became like at least in inverted commas, it was renewed every year, but there was no formal agreement other than the formal agreement taken out all those years ago when my great grandfather took one out. So they then insisted that we had a lease. And,
so they being?
The Environment Agency, Wales.
Mm-hmm.
The Environment Agency. So they refused to let us fish until we signed a lease of sorts. So that was negotiated. That's another story. Yeah, the fishery, there were 9 licences granted by the Y Board. And as I say, people, my great-grandfather, Bert Beasley, Joe Mason, Herbert Williams, Bob, that's the name, just a picture of him there in the natives. They were sort of some of the original fishermen back in the day.
So when you say fishing, fishery, what sort of fish is there?
Right. The Gruggy Rocks fishery and the Black Rock Lavenet fishery and is a salmon fishery. That's simply that. That's what they were fishing for, salmon. It's not anything else. But adjacent to that, sort of back in those days and up until roughly the early 80s, 1980s, there was people also fish with a type of lave net, very similar, for whitefish. Now, there was no license required for that, no license at all. People just done it. It was a common sight, and if you spoke to anybody in the local villages, they would fish for whitefish with a lay net, but it's completely different to the salmon fishing. It's a completely different thing. Salmon fishermen wouldn't be seen dead, sort of fishing for whitefish. You know, they were fishermen, you know, proper fishermen, if you like. But people fished for whitefish, for food for the table. It wasn't a commercial fishery or anything. It was just subsistence. And those fish would have been, you know, mullets, sole, flounder, and eels, perhaps. It was done in a completely different area. Even it was a local area, just offshore, but there were different sort of names for these areas, the Luby and the Bar, the Bedouins and the Lake. They were the whitefish fishing areas, but a completely different method, but a very similar net. Yeah, that was.
So when you talk about licensing, this is licensing to fish for salmon.
Yes, yeah. You needed this fishery. This area is regarded said to be owned. It's been handed down through. I think it originally belonged to the St. Pierre Manor House, the fishery, the fishing area, if you like. That was then gifted to the Y Board, which then become natural. The Rivers Authority, is it?
NRA.
And then the Environment Agency, and now, of late, Natural Resources Wales. So the title to the fishery has been handed down. So to fish in what is termed a private fishery, you need permission to fish. And that was, you know, in my great-grandfather's day, a lease agreement, and then in our day, latterly, sort of a lease agreement, permission to fish. In addition to that, you then need a licence to fish for salmon, as a Ron Angler would, a licence to fish for salmon.
Okay.
So, but you need the two things to be able to fish out here, because it's deemed a private fishery. Now, in the late 70s, early 80s, the River Board tried to prosecute somebody fishing for whitefish with a lave net. Now,
here
in Sibrock, Tumlows handled the case, the solicitor. The guy's name was Ted Bevan. Now, as it happens, his nephew fishes with us. He's got a license to fish, you know, for salmon. But we can't get the information off him. We've been trying to get. They reckon they won the case, but who knows? You know, it's just sitting in the pipeline. We're going to try and get that information regarding that sort of aspect of the fishing. But they tried to prosecute him. It went on for about 5 years, apparently, this case.
Why?
But he must have had, what they call it, when you don't pay for legal advice. But, you know, that's another story. But it's sort of anyway, it died out anyway. You know, things changed. People, you know, drifted away from the estuary, perhaps, certainly regarding getting fish.
So before your grandfather came here,
what
was here? There was a fishery here.
Local people would have fished for salmon.
Here?
There was no formal arrangement, as far as I understand, but people would have fished for salmon. But people probably didn't know about it. You know, it was just coming from from years and years back, people just fished for salmon. They just went out there to fish for salmon.
Mm.
But then things, I think, start to get a little bit tighter, perhaps after the First World War, and things changed as such. Because the fishery, my great-grandfather's day, was secretive, super secretive. I mean, it was, how can you say, they were explicitly told, you know, or knew not to talk about salmon fishing.
Why?
Because of money. People would be jealous. I mean, I don't know how much money was involved, but they wouldn't brag about fishing. They wouldn't tell anybody about fishing. And even in my day, sort of when I was a kid, if you walked up to Doug Brown, one of the fishermen, and said, "Any fish about Doug?" he'd have one under his arm, and he'd say, "No." They were that sort of hard and fast. And nobody outside Sibrock, reports that we probably knew about Leyden net fishing until I came into the fishery and my brother.
Mm.
It was super secretive. So nobody would really have known about this fishery.
They're being quite protective about it. Protected about, the bounty.
It's, well, yeah, probably that. You know, it's their patch. You don't want anybody coming, poachers, for instance. You know, once you start knowing that there's people, there's fish there, and there's a way of catching fish, and there's, you can get out there. You know, nobody, you know, it's a deadly, dangerous river. And,
yeah.
But if some people knew somebody was making money by catching salmon and there was a way of getting out there, they'd be watched and people would follow them out there.
Mm.
So, you know, it's all, you know, people just kept it close. And it was, as I say, up until, I would say, probably with our first war with the Environment Agency in the late 90s, nobody knew about it. Other than people, local people, and then
that's really
interesting. Yeah, it's the only reason people know about it now is because the Environment Agency tried to stop it, and it's been a difficult thing. But it's, some good has come out of it. They sort of the licenses. You know, I fished with a license first. Fished with a Leyden net first. When I was about 10 years of age. I was born in 1960, so I was probably about 1970.
With your dad?
No. All the fishing is on my mother's side of the family. So my mother, my great-grandfather, William Corbin, and my grandfather, Jack Harris, all the family grew up in the same house. 13 Camp Road, Subrook. And that was known as HQ. In my great grandfather's day.
Really? By locals and.
Yeah, everybody. Because all the salmon were taken to HQ prior to being sent off to Billingsgate or wherever back in the day. And they'd be tipped into a tin bath.
Mm.
My mother used to say that, you know, she'd have to wait until the bath was empty before they could have a bath. So the back kitchen was where they brought the fish.
What, by cart or?
No, well, carry it. They wouldn't have that many fish, but they would just bring any fish they caught would be taken there and then taken off to Portsquid Station, because there was a station there, you know, going back, you know, to the 20s and 30s, you know, that sort of date, like, you know, sort of a long time ago. But 13 Camp Road, I spent a lot of time there, you know, and sort of grew up there. I was always there seeing my grandparents, and there was always a Leyden net there. My mother had three brothers, and one of them was quite a keen fisherman. Well, actually, two of them were fishermen. One was quite keen. They never had licenses, salmon licenses, but they fished for whitefish, and I'd always been nagging to be taken out. So one beautiful summer's day, I was taken out onto the estuary.
In a boat?
We walked out from Subrook across the Roman camp there, down the foreshore, and then through the mud and gravel out to a place they call the Luby, L-U-B-E-Y. And we fished the tide out, and we stood on top of the camp, and my uncle said to me, as soon as the black stones show, the black bedwinds start to show, that's when we start walking. It was quite an easy walk then, sort of through the mud. I never had waders. I'm not quite sure if he did, but you'd have an old pair of boots, some jeans, and a t-shirt. Sort of, and the way that was done, you had a bit of a Leyden net, I mean, cobbled together, nothing like a salmon fishing Leyden net. And
so the Leyden net, was it a monofilament one, or it was a SCN?
The one my uncle had was made from some sort of, it wasn't hemp, I don't think, but it wasn't mono. But mine was made from garden sheeting, sort of. It was just anything we could find to make it, knock up a bit of a Leyden net for me, a little tiny makeshift half-size tiny Leyden net, just to have a go. So I was taken out. I fished. What you first do, you sort of get to where the black bedwinds start, and then you wait for a gravel bank called the Bar, B-A-R, to show. So you fish there for about 10 minutes,
Because it's safe, you mean? That's when you wait for it to...
The water level is dropping. This is done on a spring tide when your fish are tied out, okay? So you're waiting, you stood there, and the water's up to your waist.
And God!
And you stood there with a net in the water. The same principle as the salmon fishing. You put your hand in there and you feel for a fish. But you're not looking for a fish with when they fish for whitefish. You're just feeling for a fish going in there. And the first fish I caught was a big green eel, about 2 pound. And he asked me if I wanted to keep it. I said, yeah. So I picked out the net and dropped it into a Hessian sack. Because, again, that's what they used to use. Hessian sacks over your shoulder on a string. And put it in there. As the water level drops there, you wade onto the bar and get onto the bar, which is a high gravel bank, and then you work your way down that as the tide is dropping. The one interesting thing in those days was that you probably catch a sole there, which is, you know, don't get too many sole out there in the lave net, but always flounder. But the interesting thing back in the day, I can remember saying to him, why is the water red? And he said, well, that's the mill, baby mill. And so you're up to your waist in what was basically the effluent from the mill. and it was just pure red. You could smell it. And
why red?
Because that was the colour of the effluent that used to come out of the paper mill, Ashton paper mill at the time.
Really?
It was pumped out. They had a licence to discharge effluent. I think it was 1 hour or before and high tide, and 2 hours afterwards, 2.5 hours after, you know, don't quote me on that, but it was roughly those sort of times. But they pumped it out 24/7, forever, 24/7, and it was filthy down there, dead zone really, sort of, but...
It's gone now though, isn't it?
Gone now, it's been closed down for a few years now, there's houses being built on it at the moment. But I can remember saying to him, you know, what's that? And he said, oh, it's the effluent from the mill. But, you know, he didn't bat an eyelid. He didn't think it bad for me to be stood in it. I never knew about effluent or paper mills and chemicals and all the rest of it. But I'm still here to tell the tale. So perhaps it wasn't that bad. I don't know.
Do you remember your impressions being that first time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just a massive adventure. And, you know, sort of, and it sort of planted the seed. You know, sort of back then, and you fished in, and you were so excited, and, you know, waiting for that fish to sort of bump the net, and then you tide is ebbing away, you're walking down the bar, and they said, right, time to go now. We walk to the next mark, and you sort of walk back up the bar, it's now dry, and into what they call the luby, and... Again, it's like a channel that dries out. When you get there, it's quite wide, not much tide running through it. Again, the interesting thing about that is that where the tide in the estuary ebbs from east to west, in the luby it goes in the opposite direction. It runs out from west to east. Because in what it is, the higher ground to the west of you is sort of draining out through this particular gully. And it's, I suppose, 200-300 yards wide at the start, and then as the ebbing tide goes on, the current run gets faster in it, and then fish start to come down, and you know, you get, you know, back in the day you might get 20-25 flounder, a couple of mullet perhaps, you know, and
what are the dangers?
Dangers, I mean, you get washed off your feet. I mean, we hadn't heard of life jackets in those days. Get cut off by the tide.
Did that ever happen to you?
Cut off by the tide. When I was a kid, yeah. I mean, several times, and we never had tide tables, and sort of we'd be out there sort of playing, fishing, you know, collecting things and just exploring generally. And several times we've had to swim across gullies and sort of, you know, you just don't think of anything. Think anything of it the day. I mean, I learned to swim out there. I mean, it's, you know, your mother and all keep out the estuary, and there's, you know, of course, all the local boys, that's where we spent all our time.
In the estuary,
sort of swimming, exploring, fishing, digging bait, collecting fish and tackle. I mean, you know, that's where it all started for me, really. Sort of, you know, fishing with a rod and line, hand line. It's quite funny, really, out fishing with the boys on the boat and everything with rods and lines. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, should I say how I first started with an hand line? You know, we didn't have a fishing rod. You know, you just didn't have a fishing rod. You know, you'd have to make up a bit of a hand line.
Can you explain to you what a hand line is?
Just a piece of... you know, you'd have a stick, basically, and you'd wind line, any line you could find, basically, and a bit of monofilament tied to the end of it. And even that, we didn't go to tackle shops or anything. We just collected stuff that other people lost off the foreshore and tied it to the end of a line. And then you'd dig some garden worms at the back of my grandparents' house. And you'd be using garden worms sort of for baits, sort of thing, or kipper for conger eels out there.
So if you were growing up here, this is part of your childhood, going out there fishing and swimming.
Yeah, I mean, that was it. I mean, our childhood was, you know, when you think about it, pretty tough, I suppose, but it was, you know, we had the estuary to play in. I mean, we'd swim in there endlessly. We'd swim from the several dock to Black Rock and back. At high tide, sort of, you know, with the last of the flood, we'd get it diving off the dock, swim to Black Rock, and then go back with the first of the ebb. And
did anyone get into trouble?
No, never. Nobody in my time, I never heard of anybody drowning. I mean, we had a few close calls. I can remember a boy, I won't mention his name, but we were all swimming in the dock with a water from the Severn Tunnel pumping station is pumped out. It's quite a good swimming area in there, pretty cold with that the spring water, but it was high tide and somebody pushed the one boy in and he couldn't swim. So, you know, which they thought was great fun. Like, so he's flapping around in the water, floating, quite sort of big lump of a boy, you know, one of the bigger boys, like. And he's there in the water flapping around, and all of a sudden he said, "I can't swim." And he just went straight down, gone. And there's no tide in there as such, but it's pretty deep water. So of course, two or three of the other boys dived in to catch hold of him and pull him out. And he was so big and strong, he was just fighting everybody off.
Yeah, well, that's but then he
goes straight back down again, and straight back and in one until he was full of water and sort of quietened down a bit, that they were able to sort of drag him out.
Oh my God.
But that was just part and parcel of the day. I mean, it was, you know, fishing and sort of, as I say, collecting bait, looking for fishing tackle, running
and
around the rocks.
It had been for your parents and your grandparents too, you know, generations.
Yes. Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, they've all sort of grown up there and sort of, you know, yeah, it was a pretty idyllic life when you look back at it, as far as, you know, you didn't have to, so nobody was watching you, you just got on with it and sort of, when you went swimming, you didn't have a towel, you'd dry in your jumper and sort of, you know, that would, and think nothing of it. You know, today, parents would be horrified.
Well, yeah.
What we were doing, you know, they're perhaps overly protective, I don't know, but we were just, as long as you come back at the end of the day, it was no problem. You know, you did have a mobile phone to check, you know, it was...
Oh,
strange.
God, I know.
But, it was a different world, a different life. But for me, it planted the seed of fishing, being taken out there when I was a young boy, come back. When I got back, my eel had gone. It had gone through a hole in the corner of the Essien sack. But we had a few flatfish, and my grandmother would cook them up with chips in blooming, great big, I can remember it now, a great big chip pan full of white fat.
Every house had one of those.
Yeah, so, but she cooked lovely, beautiful chips and fried a flounder up for me, and that's what we used to do. So it was, we went out then, anyway, time went on. Eventually I'd wander, sneak out there on my own, if I could find an old net and be out there with the boys, two or three of us. One of the fishermen now, Paul Watkins, you know, he grew up with me, a year or so older than me, but he'd come out there, two or three of the other boys, we'd sneak out there and we'd be up to all sorts, you know, we'd find any net we could and sort of, you know, peg it out there and fish with the lave net, fish with the rods, you know, you turn over rocks looking for eels, just endless sort of fun. Then, of course, you know, you all I've been then up until about sort of 14, and then other things kick in and you sort of drifted away from it. And then exams, school,
women
yeah, you know, all that sort of thing. Yeah. And then all before you knew it, apprentice, and then before you got married quite young, and sort of house mortgage quite young. And then I spent the next 20 years, or until I was about in my late 40s, sorry, 30s, working 7 days a week. So it was, it was, you know, all of a sudden, any thoughts of fishing, really, even the odd rod fishing trip, you know, were gone. Like, I had other things on my mind, other sort of things, and fishing was forgotten, really. It was, time moved on. And then, in the mid to late 1990s, we had a phone call from the secretary of the association. They didn't call it, they may have still called it a syndicate then. Dick Obday, he was the secretary then. He was based in the shipyard at Subrock. He phoned up and he said, would you like to have a license? And a lead net fishing license. And you and your brother. And I said, yeah, of course we would. I don't know where they got our names from, but at the time, one of the old fishermen, Ron Williams, and Doug Brown, who we vaguely sort of, you know, would bump into, a new ex-fisherman. It was their licenses, basically. Because what would happen is that these fishermen would stop fishing, but they would not give up their license.
Okay.
They call it dead man's shoes locally, because dead man's shoes, because they, you know, the license would only sort of turn up when they were dead. And that's one of the reasons, or why the fishery was sort of dying. You know, the sort of numbers were dwindling. So we had the call off Dick, Richard Obday, and we said yes. And said, well, what do we do? Or just turn up down Black Rock in the fishing season. It was basically it, like, you know. And so we're rushing around now. We had an idea of how to make a net, and so we cobbled together the net the best we could.
But they, Richard Hobday, he knew of your family's connection.
Yes, yeah, yeah. They're all separate people, and sort of they would have known it, you know. They weren't, you know, sort of, they're a quite close-knit bunch, really, all of them. And but they would have heard our names, you know, knew we were interested in fishing and so on and so forth. And, you know, obviously known the family. And but it was fate, I think, you know, all of it. Sort of fate that I was taken out when I was a young boy. Fate that all of a sudden those licenses became available when they did. So we grabbed them with both hands and cobbled together a net of sorts, and turned up one day on a fishing tide in season. You know, sent that, gave Dick our money, our license money, and got our licenses, turned up fishing, and we knew Den O'Lee, who was still fishing, Bob, and Dick really fish. I've never seen him fish, but basically when we turned up, there was just Dennis Lee and Bob Leonard fishing. It was Peter may have had a license, Peter, Bob's brother at the time as well, but didn't see too much of him in the early days. So basically it was me, Richard, my brother, and Dennis and Bob fishing. And, you know, they sort of quietly introduced us to it, sort of, and started to show us the ropes. Not immediately, you know, until they sort of check you out first, you know, on your attitude and all the rest of it. But quietly, we sort of become the, you know, members of the team, sort of thing. And then, a year or so later, you had the first sort of thing. I've never sort of thought or heard or sort of understood or had anything to do with politics, and you know, especially fishing politics. Mm-hmm. And before we knew it, you know, you had this the 1999 baseline salmon baseline laws or whatever come about, and that was when 60% of the season was taken away to protect salmon stocks. And it's funny now when you look back, because well, what are we going to do? You know, we're not having any effect on salmon stocks. Why, you know, why would they do that to us? And so we basically wrote two sentences to that effect, and I got the letter at home somewhere, or a copy of it, and everybody signed it, and it's like signatures just like all over, like you were doing school sort of thing, you know, one diagonal, you know, just all over the sheet of paper, and just send it off. And then, you know, of course that didn't do any good, so that came back, and anyway, it was a national thing, really. I mean, they were going to do it, and they'd done it, and perhaps, you know, it needed to be done in to a certain degree, but, you know, there you go. That was, we'd been in the group 5 minutes, and all of a sudden 60% of the season had gone. We used to start in February. February the 2nd was the start date for salmon fishing on the estuary. Then another year or so passes, and Seven Estuary Action Plan. That was the next thing, and the writing was on the wall with that. They basically, they were, all the other salmon fisheries had been closed down. It was just us on the Welsh region of the estuary.
Where were the others then? Where had the others?
Goldcliff, Putcherank, Undy, Putcherank, Porton, Putcherank, the stop boats in Chepstow, all over like a 30 odd year period, one by one. St. Nets, Mathern, Slime Road, I mean, that's drifting into England perhaps, but all the Putcheranks, you know, would sort of, you know, bar a few upstream on the Severn, had been closed. The Welsh region, there was nothing other than us left. And
had they been closed because of the decline in salmon numbers?
Yes, well, that was the reasoning behind it. You know, bought out, closed down by, you know, one by one, chipped away. There had been a decline in salmon stocks, and the Environment Agency or the Natural Rivers Authority, I mean, had a program, really, of closure, as far as I can see it. And then there was just us left. And when the Seven Estuary Action Plan, the proposed action plan, came out, it was obvious to us we were next in line. And Dick, Richard Obday, phoned us up and said, look, they want to meet us at the Subrock Club, the Subrock Non-Political, the Subrock Non-Political Club in Subrock there. So eventually that was arranged, and I was, 39-ish then, 40 perhaps, I don't know, full of fight, obviously. And my brother, you know, I had my brother with me as well. There was Dick Obday, I think Pete Leonard, Dan Lee, and Bob at the meeting. And two people from the Environment Agency turned up. Head of enforcement, I won't mention his name, but and another nice enough guy, Mr. Purvis. And they sat down and started to run through it all, blah 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 blah, you know, all the spiel. And I said to my brother previously, I said, right, you sit right at the back, I said, and everything they say, write it down and make sure that they see you writing it down. So anyway, it was unnerving him a little bit, and anyway, I said, that's fair, I said, fair enough, I said, you know we understand that, you know, what you said, but can we show you this? And I brought out a petition that we'd started against further restrictions. Well, if I did, the head of enforcement, he just hit the ceiling, basically, sort of. And we can, his words were, we can close you down anytime we like. Anytime we like.
Oh, really?
And, of course, it was a red rag to a bull to me.
They?
No. Basically, they need to go through sort of, you know, do certain things to be able to close us down. But he went off on one, and it was, you know, some of the things he said. But anyway, that sort of showed us really what they were about. And apparently they were going to publish this report after, I think it was 6 weeks or 8 weeks. Mm. It took them a year to do it, because immediately we were invited to the Welsh Assembly with a 3,500 signature petition. We met Carwyn Jones, who was the Minister for Rural Affairs at the time, Rodri Morgan. It was just when the National the Welsh Assembly was formed, and we all went there with all our little placards, a few little posters and things. You know, it was quite, you know, pathetic, really. I mean, we, a couple of things stuck to cardboard things, and but they welcomed us and sort of. And Carwyn Jones, he said to me, I said, look, you know, we were chatting, and he said, look, they got to come through me, and I said. But he said, he just looked at me and said, they're going to come through me. So it never happened. It took him over a year to publish a report, and we were okay at the end of the day.
Getting ready to go fishing again already, look.
Yeah, everybody.
Well, it's a bit like May, June already.
Yeah, not bad, is it?
I can't believe it. I don't know what's going on. It's really weird. Everything's budding. Well, you've got some marigolds coming up, the rose bushes budding, they're flaming.
Oh, yeah.
It's weird.
Seasons, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it should be foot deep in snow or whatever.
That might happen yet.
Yeah, we'll have it.
We are warned, aren't we? Went out and fished a couple of times. Went out yesterday on Long Rock, down right to the end, and fished that back in from the lower. And with one little codling,
is
it?
Yeah, quiet out there now.
It is quiet out there. Everybody's been saying that. There was a match, Newport Sea Fishing, Sea Anglers Club, on Sudbrook along here.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm trying to get the report on it, but I can't find the report on it. So.
I expect it'll be online somewhere.
Yeah, he did send me the site, but I went on there, it's not been put up.
Yeah.
I thought there were five fish in the sea, tree.
I think one fell out. Oh. Or somebody whipped it, I know.
Oh.
Yeah, it was
Hello, you go again.
Everybody.
Can we just go back to the very beginning? Your great grandfather, right. William Corbin. Tell me about him.
Yeah, William Corbin, right. He, as I say, grew up in Chepstow, Nestor, and went off to war. I mean, he died when I was perhaps 6, 7, 8, that sort of age. And I could always remember him. You know, my brother can't remember him, but I can remember him in Camp Rose, Sudbrook, not fishing. You know, he was too old then, and... They had a massive cast iron range in the kitchen, in the back room there where they lived. My sort of great grandparents lived in one sort of bit, and grandparents in the other. But I have three or four memories of him. That's all. The one is sat in the chair, always his chair on the one side of the fire, and my great grandmother on the other side, on the rocking chair, wooden hard rocking chair on the other side, and he was in a big soft high back chair on the other side. I always remember him doing that. I can remember also them walking me down the cliff road at the back end of Sudbrook there by the shipyard, and I can also remember him making me a whistle.
A wooden whistle?
No. It was made from a big bulb of seaweed. If you look in seaweed down there, you get sort of bladder rack. I'm not sure what it's called, but one of the bigger. I don't know how he'd done it, and he'd probably. But I can remember him with a little knife, bringing up a piece of seaweed with the big bulb, and making some sort of whistle. And sat on the Roman camp just at the back of the house there.
Yeah.
On the point by the Holy Trinity Church, right on the end there, and there's like a little depression on the end, and I was sat there with him, and he made a whistle. And I can also remember him with his tobacco tin, mixing two types of tobacco, making a roll up, and sat there smoking it. So, but apart from that, you know.
So, had he been a fisherman before the war?
He must have been,
must have been.
You know, the fact they say there's a lot of, you know, fishermen in his family, sort of thing. Mm. He was a Victorian. I mean, he was, you know, a Victorian, you know, sort of. But as I say, he fished up till he was, must have been in his late 70s. And Bob, the fisherman that trained me and Richard, fished with my great grandfather. So Bob would have been a young boy then. So
and Bob passed away last
year. So Bob, even though my great grandfather didn't pass down all the salmon fishing bit, Bob did, which again I think was probably fate, because Bob was the youngest of the fishermen.
What was it, Bob?
Leonard. Mm-hmm. Leonard. That's him behind the picture in the
here.
The Wye Valley tourist people came down to take a picture of us, and that's the picture. He was wearing all the publications. Bob turned up there. He said, "Bob, he hadn't had a shave," and he said, "Well, what's the matter with your mouth?" Oh, he said, "I forgot my bottom teeth."
Oh, that's
so
great.
He looks a little bit.
Oh, that's so great.
I mean, Bob showed us everything, really. But when he fished with my great grandfather, I mean, they were pretty close as well. And you know, the classic tale is Bob repeated endlessly was that they were down the hole, the other side of the bridge, fishing. My great grandfather, Bob, and two or three others, and my great grandfather had a fish in the net. He couldn't pick the net up. He was 77 years of age, and it was his 77th birthday. Luckily, there were men either side of him to catch out of the reams. They pulled it up, and the fish was 57 pounds in weight. Monster fish. You know, most fishermen, Leivner fishermen, never seen a fish over 40 pounds.
57 pounds.
57 pounds.
Salmon.
Yeah. And
wow, is that what they call an American trunk?
God knows, but it's quite impressive. But that was taken to a Bob again. Tell a story. He took it to a hotel in Tintern, knocked on the back door at night, which all sounds a bit dodgy to me. But it's sort of that he must have had a sort of contact to sell it, and the guys. He showed him the fish. He said, "Never seen a fish like it." And the hotel owner had a party of anglers in there. I think he owned a fishing beat, Bob said. Mm. And Bob took it in and rolled it out on the carpet. And sort of, the landlord said, "That's your target for tomorrow, boys." So,
why? So, that's a great story.
I think Bob may have added a pound or two to it over the decades.
Oh, everyone does that, don't they? Yeah.
But that was his thing. But he'd say that my great-grandfather was mad keen for it, you know, all the time. Bob would say there'd be a stinking night. You know, it'd be tipping down with rain. You know, the wind wouldn't be quite right. And Bob lived, on the farm. Mm. And he would look down towards a boat, it'd be pitch dark at night, and he would see a dim light on the boat. And he'd know then that that was my great grandfather down there, so he'd have to go down there.
Really?
To fish.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So fishing at night time isn't unknown?
No, they would fish at night. They would fish at night. There was more fish about, you know, back in the day, years and years ago.
Yeah.
And there would always be a chance of a fish swimming into the net. Because with a lave net, you're fishing in two ways. It's completely different to anything else. You know, when I mentioned white fishing and all the rest of it, you're out there standing in a traditional spot, okay? And even though the fishery is defined, there is a line running from Caldecott right up to the chutes in the middle, around to Black Rock. But people think you can just fish anywhere, and you can't. You can fish only in specific spots. And
is it possible that fishermen have stood in those spots for hundreds of years?
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. You know, there's all sorts of things down there, what we call stanks, which are lines of rocks on edge that, you know, our fishermen didn't put them there, but they were put there long, long before that. But yeah, I mean, there's specific spots with names only known by the fishermen out there. You run through them, the Gut, Lighthouse Pier, Gruggy, the Marl, then there's the Hole, and then there's the Grandstand. That's the salmon fishing spots. But there's also other names out there. Monkey Temp is another one, sort of. But these were names that don't appear on maps and sort of are used by the fishermen to describe where they fish. And the fishermen.
So is it? So that's just something you all share anecdotally.
Yeah.
It hasn't been ever logged on a map.
Again, we are, you know, in recent years. I mean, obviously, we've tried to get the fish in, sort of, you know, out there. You know,
yeah.
And you can see, you know, what we've done. You know, it's quite, but years ago, you could talk in a pub and nobody would know what you were talking about. But
it's a secret language in the world.
Well, yeah, sort of, yeah. But we, you know, we'll typically meet here and. With laying that fish in, it's all about three things. It's about the size of the tide, height of the tide, which we get from a tide table, the Arrowsmiths, the direction and strength of the wind. Okay, you want it as calm as possible, light as possible, the wind, but winds in certain directions, you would select certain fishing spots. So say we had a southeasterly wind, 5 miles an hour, you know, 10 miles an hour, you would choose to fish in what we call Gruggy.
Okay.
Because when, and what happens, you can either walk, we wade out, or we take the boat. And when you get there, you put the net in front of you, open the net out, unfold it, put it in front of you, put your hand in the net to feel for a fish swimming in. Years ago, there's more fish about, you'd have more chance of one just actually swimming into the net. But the second part of it, you're looking, continuously scanning and looking for a fish.
So does that mean you're reading the surface of the water?
Yeah, the calmer the better, so the flatter the better. So you're looking for a ripple, the wake, the loom of the fish as it swims through the water. And this might only happen...
Wake and the loom?
We call the wake the loom, the sort of...
Oh, do you?
The line going through the water.
Is that unique to you here?
I don't know, but that's what we say. We say we're looking for the wake, the loom, the mark of fish... swimming through the water, and that might only last for a few seconds, and then you dip down and be gone. So if you miss it, you won't see the fish. In the summertime, and when we fish now, we can only fish from the 1st of June to the 31st of August on paper. Bob always used to say that the water become warm and the fish are always go slow and quiet. Okay, so they're moving very quiet, so you might only get one chance to see them. If you see the fish, you pick up the net, he's not going to come to you, and then you've got to try and get around the fish onto his nose. No good being behind him or on his side, so you've got to move through the water as quick as you dare, and you've got to know what's under the water to do that, because some areas is full of holes and gullies, others
you might drop suddenly,
you break your leg. And there's a particular gully out there now that never used to be there. When they built the second Seven Crossing, they ran a trench from the crossing to the red beacon on the Lady Bench, which is about 2 foot deep and about 18 inches wide. There's a cable running through it to take electricity to the beacon. Now, they didn't fill it in properly with concrete, and it's right behind what we call the pillars, two little rocks where we fishing in Gruggy. And if you, with a gully like that, you will break your leg if you run through it. So we try to show all the fishermen, train them sort of not to do that, but when they see a fish, what do they do?
So this might sound like a stupid question, Martin. Why do you use nets and not, you know, a line?
Well, in the Severn Estuary, you can't, it's not practical. You couldn't fish for salmon with a line. You know, it's, you know, it wouldn't work. You know, you can't do it. I mean, it's, you know, it's completely different to rod and line fishing. You know, people, it's quite annoying, really, that you know, you get all the time with the powers that be, you get this rod fishing, net fishing thing, and you know, it's all lumped into one. Well, it's a completely different thing altogether, you know, completely different thing. It's okay, you catch fish, but it's like, you know, comparing a cat and a dog. It's all got four legs, but it's a completely different thing. You know, it's our way of life out there, you know, sort of fishing with a laid net. You know, it's been passed down to me, and you know, I hope to pass it on to others. And
so who taught you how to make nets?
Right, when I came into the fishing in the 90s, all the nets were not hand knitted. Okay, they still made the frames exactly as we make them from willow, ash and pine.
What, that crop nearby? Come.
Each fisherman would make their own nets, and or perhaps not always the case, you know, because you get some more proficient and more sort of keen than others, and more handy, if you like. But they still made the nets from the willow for the reams, pine for the headboard, ash for the rock staff. But what had happened over the years is that until the 1950s, 60s, the nets were made from hemp twine. Okay, and there was one particular guy in Subrock that lived next door, 12 Camp Road, Smacker Williams, that was proficient in knitting nets. And Bob used to tell us that he could knit a day and a half.
Really?
The net is a horseshoe shaped, but I think it was probably a family effort. They would hang it up on a bar in the living room, or a rope, and knit off that. But a day and a half. The hemp twine would only last for two seasons. So they would be constantly knitting nets. Of course, come say the 1960s, modern materials come in. This stuff, polyester nylon, and you know, no doubt Smacker knitted all the nets, and these things are virtually indestructible. Okay, so all of a sudden, the nets were not being remade, and the skills weren't being passed down, because they all had nets.
Yeah.
And then 5 years, 10 years passed. What happened? You know, nets, you know, eventually they get ripped and all the rest of it, lost, and one thing and another. And
so someone like Smacker Williams, would it be in a full-time job?
No. He was... It was all... Nobody really made a living out of this fishery after the Second World War. What we would call a living. It was subsistence. You know, they would get, you know, a few bob. You know, there was no living to be made out of it. Not, you know, for a long time back, really. You know, it was just in addition to whatever else they'd done, their pension or their hobbles, their little jobs. It was quite an odd sort of life. It was just a little bit extra, I think.
Do you know when your grandfather died then? So who did his... Was it his daughter who... So you said it was passed through your mother's line.
Yeah. My grandmother was his daughter. And then... You know, my grandmother had four children. My mother and four boys. So
did your grandmother have anything to do with this?
Nope, nothing at all. Even my great-grandmother, you know, I can't, don't recall her sort of having anything to do with the fishing, really. And my mother, no, not really. You know, it was all really, I mean...
Your grandfather?
He did, yeah. My grandfather fished a little bit. He'd never had a licence, but he fished for whitefish. But I don't recall him ever say he went... sort of salmon fishing, sort of, you know, not 100% sure about that, sort of, but what can I say? But it was mainly my uncle that you know, told me about it and sort of showed me how to do it, like
who's
I said
your
before.
Uncle?
Philip Harris. And then he, you know, not long after he took me to.
He's the one who took you out the first day?
Yeah, Philip. He, not long after that, he emigrated to Australia.
Oh.
Sort of £10 poms at the time, like, you know. So off he went.
So what other exhibitions with your uncle do you remember? What sort of things did you do, fishing-wise?
He was a young man then. He was a young man. He was a rod and line. He fished with a rod and line, but he also did fish for whitefish, but he never had a salmon licence either. The oldest son, my uncle John, He was taken out by my great grandfather. He told me that fishing, but they didn't sort of hit it off. With my great grandfather, everything had to be done right. There was no, you know, you didn't talk. If you were out there, you would not utter a word. And you know what he would think of some of the boys we got with us now on their phones every 2 minutes and all the rest of it, I don't know, but you would not utter a word, and you would do everything to the book. With us out there, you know, you follow a set routine, and that's what keeps it sort of safe, like, you know. Sort of, but he would, you know, he was a Victorian type, Bob used to say, and he was a boat builder.
He's a boat builder?
Boat builder as well.
Your great grandfather?
Yeah, he was a shipwright.
Really? Yeah. Where?
Don't know. He was a shipwright by trade. He could.
Really?
They say he could put a roof on a house with by eye.
Wow.
Sort of thing. And there's a picture of him on the Facebook. Repairing a boat.
Really?
It's quite an interesting thing with that Facebook again. Saying about that, a guy got in contact. Duncan. I can't remember his name now, but he said we may have some pictures of. You know, this lot, slot sort of back in the day, and he sent us a picture of Grantley, which was Bob's father, with a salmon which got to be 40 pound stood there, and we got no pictures of Grantley. And he said how they met was they really live Pill, not Pill, on the other side somewhere anyway, of the estuary. His family set off, or his, you know, great, his grandfather or his great grandfather set off on the Severn Estuary in the boat with a couple of others, and they got into trouble. So they eventually come in at Black Rock. Though the Home Guard arrested them or took them into sort of custody. They, you know, something
think
like,
they were along, invaded,
yeah, something like that. Anyway, but eventually, anyway, they sort of met Grantley. And his wife at the time, and who lived just on the cliff edge, just up there. And I think they all then sort of become sort of involved. Like there's lots, there's a picture of them all sort of, you know, they become good friends anyway. So
that's
people from the other
story.
Side of the estuary, like, yeah,
really?
It was. And the picture on the website is my great grandfather repairing one of their boats, I think.
Really? So, so on the Black Rock Facebook
page? Yeah, on the.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
Yeah,
I want to look at that.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. But he's there, he's only a little small wiry fella, like. And,
so it functioned during the war, though, so this was still running, Black Rock.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's Second World War, yeah, yeah. Must have been, yeah.
So I wonder if it was an important source of food.
Well,
or did most of it go off to London?
I honestly don't know, really. No. I mean, they would have sold it. But people never starved down here. I mean, grandfather used to say, you'll never starve and you'll never freeze because you could go out there and catch a fish anytime you like. And you turn over a stone down there and you get a fish, you know, an eel. The other thing regarding keeping warm, I mean, they used to have a bit of coal, but normally it was just wood. And just off Subrook, just off the camp there, you've got an area called the Wharf. It's not like it is today. It's all filled in now. It's all this green stuff, this marsh grass type stuff they've planted years ago has completely changed the foreshore front from Maygood to Subrook. It's not what, like it was when I was a kid at all. And at the Wharf, you had, it was like a bay, and you had actually a shell beach there. You know, and they used to call it the beach. You know, that's where they went to the beach.
Really?
Back in the day.
Really?
Yeah, it was. They wouldn't go off to, you know, wherever. They would be, you know, people with no money would be down on the beach.
Not even so, in your time?
Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, there was still sand and shell there.
Why?
Like coarse sand.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of wood washed up there. And what they used to do is put a stone on the wood.
Yeah.
So anybody who, if you've seen a stone on top of a log, somebody claimed it.
Oh my God, really?
And I can remember a little cart in the back garden of my grandparents' house, and that's what they would use. They would go down with a cart and bring the wood back and chop it up.
Amazing.
So
tell me about Bob Leonard.
Yeah, Bob.
Is your chap, he passed away last year?
Yeah, he passed away this time last year, January, February, and the nicest bloke you could wish to meet. And he grew up, his dad was Grantley Leonard, he was one of, you know, several children, and Grantley, his father, was a fisherman. A lot of the fishermen in the group, they were all related, cousins, Dougie, Jim Foster. It was like a little hamlet down here. Okay, his dad was like a butcher. They butchered cows down, sheep and all sorts down here. McColeman, all sorts. And Bob, I'm not sure if he was one of the youngest, but he was brought into the fishing when he was a young man. He worked in the brewery. He finished up in the brewery anyway, but he'd done loads of different jobs, Bob. But he was basically the one who taught us about how to fish. As I say, when we joined the fishing, he took us under our wing, and we had a little boat, and they weren't, at that time, they were struggling to get it into the water, because you know, it's quite laborious trying to get that boat down from the foreshore down onto a mooring, what we call the bay, onto a chain mooring. And they were basically just fishing in the gut, just off Black Rock by ear. They weren't able to go sort of offshore. So Bob was glad in a way that, you know, we served a purpose, really, I suppose.
Two young boys come in.
And, you know, and over the years, we got closer and closer, you know, sort of Bob, me and Richard. And basically, at one point, it was just me, Bob and Richard fishing. And Bob, I'd say to him, it could be quite rough down there, and he'd say, where do you want to go, Bob? Then they all, I said, a bit rough, Bob. No, it's all right. And off we go. You'd always want to go down to the hole. He said, we'll get a fish down there. Off we go and sort of down there. It was always a chance, but he loved it. It was his favourite spot as such. You know, he'd always want to go down there. If the wind was right, because you always got to go with the wind. You can't go against the wind. But he was a sort of, he showed us the ways. When my brother and I came into the fishing, it wasn't like it is today, okay? You had to do it for yourself. You had to make your own. When the youngsters come into the fishing today, we help them, sort of, you know, we'll help them make a net and all the rest of them, show them the ropes. But, they would not show you a great deal. You know, it was just different completely. But yeah. Bob did take us under our wing, and he'd tell us all the old stories and sort of, you know, show us how to fish, what to do, what not to do.
So what sort of stories did he tell you? What sort of things did he show you to do?
He told us one story. The one was, there's a railway siding just in Black Rock where the Queen, the royal family, used to come in overnight to stop on their way back to London. And the one day he sat there and he said, yeah, me and Doug were walking back from the fishing. We had two salmon. And who should we bump into was Prince Philip. Now, he said, I'm going back, this must have been the 50s. And he said, oh yeah, he sort of said hello, good morning, and ended up giving him a salmon. So that was on the row, he said, because there was a line of cottages on the siding, they're gone now, and where Dougie and a few of the others lived. They've all been, and they were walking on, and they bumped into Philip.
That's hilarious. And
he wouldn't lie, he did. So I'd often tempted to write to Prince Philip to ask him if he remembers the event.
Yeah,
he'd tell you about, oh crikey, we would, how they've been converted now, the houses, so you drove past, I think it's the first house, the stone house, and when we first started off, that's where we used to keep the nets, they'd always kept the nets in there, it was just Bob's barn. And we'd done a little exhibition for somebody in there. You know, I'm going back more than 15 years ago. And we were in there setting out all the pictures and all the rest of it. And I said to Bob, I said, what's that? And there was a wooden post with a ring in it in the corner of this barn. And post was an old post with a big steel ring in it. And he said, oh, that's where we used to draw him in. I said, what? We draw him in on that. He said, you know, as a matter of fact. I said, draw what in? He said, the beast. And I'm looking at him, I said, what? And he said, yeah, we put a rope through there, we pull the beast in through the door in the back, and then boom, hit him over the edge with a sledgehammer.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not joking. Why? But he was a countryman, like, he was, and they, as I say, his father was, he used to be a butcher and all the rest of it. And even on the door frame of that particular building, there were two real, like, hooks, if you like. And again, there was one missing, but the one little forged hook. I said, well, what's that, Bob? And he said, well, that's where we used to hang up the sheep.
And, why?
And there'd be blood running down the road, like, you know?
But,
you know, that's how they done it in those days.
I mean, so what sort of cautionary tales did he ever tell you?
Black fog was a big one, I suppose.
Black fog?
Yeah, black fog. He used to tell us, beware of the black fog, you know, when we started off and all the rest of it. And, you know, we'd take it all with a pinch of salt. And what happens is that you can be out there fishing, and the fog will descend and you just can't see nothing, basically. And he likened it to somebody just turning off the light. And I think he was probably talking more so when it's dark, you know, in the evening perhaps. But he would always go on about, be very careful with the fog, you know, the fog and all the rest of it. Take your compass and, you know, sort of be, know what you're doing. And we'd take it with pinch of salt. We'd never seen nothing, sort of just didn't bother us really. But then my brother one day was out there in Gruggy on his own. He hadn't been fishing that long, but he's a river fella, like, and he sort of knows about the estuary. He spent a lot of time out there, and he said he was out there 20 minutes before the end of the fishing, lovely and calm morning, early morning, when we were able to fish in the early part of the year. And he looked to the west, there was a bank of fog coming in. And he took compass bearing, picked his net up, got onto the bank out there mid-channel, and it enveloped him within minutes, and he couldn't hear the traffic on the bridge. He couldn't hear the water coming out of the pumping station, Severn Tunnel pumping station, where it flows out by the dock. Couldn't hear, just closed all the noise out completely, and he couldn't see his hand in front of his face. It was so thick.
That's scary.
So he knew he had 20 minutes to get back to the last channel of the gut before it started filling up behind him. So he got across a reef called the Lady Bench and another little gully, onwards then to the gut. So he was picking his way back as best he could, sort of had his bearing, sort of knew the terrain differs all the time. And he got a good understanding of that, watching his feet, trying not to panic. When he got to the guts, the last gully, it had filled in, and he went through on his tiptoes. So he had no radio, no phone, no life jacket, no nothing. Right. So he was very lucky to get back.
Like, yeah. That.
So
very,
very lucky. But yeah, he'd.
Because I'm always amazed when you put these photographs up. I'm thinking, because I've only crossed the estuary on the bridge, you know, and it always looks like such a treacherous stretch of water to me.
Oh yeah. It's deadly. I mean, it's you get caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, and you're dead. There's no doubt, you will drown. But
really,
it's unforgiving. I was out there a couple of times. I've nearly come unstuck. One was, I used to work in a steelworks, and on shifts, and I would do anything when the tide was right to get out to go fishing. So I'd be on a night shift, and they'd all say to me, why do you always take your holidays 2 hours here and 2 hours there? And I would just, you know, it'd be 10 till 6 at night, and I'd be wanting to get out to that past 2 in the morning sort of thing, and you just knew it. But anyway, this one morning I was pretty tired, mate, and the fishing was at about 3 in June, so you're talking about just getting light when the fishing starts, which is what these days is when we, the only time we'll ever fish in the day. So I finished work at about 2, drove down to Black Rock, nobody asked down here, so I'm on my own. So off I go, it was pretty calm, on a bad tide, so I thought I'd go down the oar. Didn't have the engine, so I had to row down, and we always used to keep three oars in the boat, two for rowing, one for sculling. So jumped in the boat, took it off the mooring, rowed out into the stream, heading down towards the bridge, went under the bridge, just starting to get light. Again, in those days, you know, didn't have life jackets or nothing really, and the way to do it, when you, the hole is quite a treacherous place, because what happens, you've got like a deep area and a shallow area and then another deep area, and the idea is to anchor on this like rocky reef we call the hole, and there's a bar that marks it, so you know, supporting you, in theory you can't go wrong. With an engine you'll go past the bar and then come back up against the ebbing tide. Okay. It's got the, but you, it's impossible to row against the tide, the tide is so fierce, it might be 5 or 6 knots, so it's just tearing through there. So what you do is stop well before the bar and the reef and turn the boat round with the oars, whip it round with the oars, and then bring the oars in and go forward to the anchor. And as the boat goes back down backwards, you throw the anchor out, and hopefully you'll grip and you'll end up in the right place. So I rowed down, I spun the boat round, positioned the boat the best I could, going backwards down with the tide now to my mark. I run, well, not run, I try to get forward as quick as I can, so I'm in a hurry to get the anchor down. And I get my foot caught in an oar on the way forward, and I go over the side of the boat. So I'm half in, half out. The oar flew up in the air and it was gone. And I'm hanging there. Sort of, I let go of the anchor, sort of, and it was a nightmare. And I just,
how frightening. Were you scared?
It happened so quick. And I just, I was there, am I in, am I out? Just managed to drag myself back over. The boat was tipping, but I just managed to pull myself back into the boat.
Jesus,
and nobody would have known I'd been gone. No. You know, so just
you were
like
lucky,
that.
Weren't you?
Yeah, very lucky.
Did you stay or did you come back
in? No, I carry on fishing.
Oh,
so, but it was just, you know, a wake-up call, like, you know, really.
Yeah.
And you know, I hasten to say that these days, you know, we all got life jackets and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
When I started, none of them wore anything like that, and most of them couldn't swim. Not that swimming's going to do you much good out there, but we said, what are we going to do? We used to say, what are we going to do if the boat goes down or we hit something? Or they would just say, do this, do that, and you know, you're just going to drown. And you all got waders on, like, you know, you just got no chance. So we're pretty safety conscious these days.
So you also often post about some of the amazing things you find.
Yeah, I mean, it's, what have we found over the years? I mean, you know, somebody asked me that today, and probably the most, you know, the best thing we've found, I suppose, is the fishing baskets, ancient fishing baskets that are found on the fishing grounds. Now, when they built the second Seven Crown, when we were kids, we would go out and find baskets occasionally, okay? These fishing baskets.
You mean like this? Putchers, you mean?
No, not putchers. Like this.
Oh, really? Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Off Subrook, you would find them, and they would be uncovered one day and gone the next. Covered back up, I should say, the next, when we were kids, and never give it a second thought. When they built Second Salmon Crossing, it altered the estuary completely. I mean, you wouldn't believe the changes out there. You know,
what do you mean?
The foreshore, for a start. I mean, there were fishing communities in Caldicot Pill.
Yeah.
Not salmon fishing, whitefish fishing communities that used to walk from Caldicot Pill, Caddistown they used to call it, out to the Luby and the Bear and the Bedouins and the lake beyond that.
Yeah.
There might be dozens of them in there. That used to fish on a regular basis to get subsistence.
Yeah.
And you would walk out from Caldicot Pill and the mud and shingle would be no deeper than that.
Hmm.
Okay, ankle deep, thigh deep. Ankle deep, calf deep.
Hmm.
Easy walk, anybody could do it. When they built the bridge, the mud level increased substantially. It's now, you'd be up to your thighs. It's impossible to do it. Absolutely impossible to do it. It's changed that much out there. It's getting deeper, I think.
Really?
And that's in the Caldicot sort of suburb area. Again, when I used to walk out when I was a kid, it was quite easy. Now, when you get sort of anywhere near the Luby out there, it's almost impossible. But that's one big change. Also, behind the caissons, some of the caissons, you've got massive gravel banks built up, loose stone, which has altered the flow of the estuary. But the main one, I'd say, is the depth of the mud on the foreshore. Quite substantial. And it's impossible to walk out there now from there.
It must be a thrill finding something there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, finding those baskets, as I say, when we were kids, we used to see them occasionally and thought nothing of it. And then after the bridge was built, certain areas out there started to scour away. It's constantly changing. You've got pools where there were never pools before, banks where there were never banks before. And then the one day we were out there, it was 2006, I think, after a winter storm. And we stumbled across, not one, but about two dozen of these baskets. Also hedging, putts.
Hedging, did you say?
Hedging is like a leader that leads into a bigger fish trap. You've got those big putts there that there's a copy of. We found those out there.
Oh.
All turned to peat as such. Not peat, but, old, very old. Because what happens, the silt is scoured away, you get down to the blue clay, and that's where the stuff is, okay? And we had never seen so many, and again, we sort of hesitated a little bit, sort of left it, and then before long, it wasn't getting recovered, like it did years ago.
Yeah.
It wouldn't get recovered, it was just scouring and scouring, and the rocks would roll across the estuary bed and smash them up. So we thought we'd better do something about it, so we phoned Cadw. And a guy called Rick Turner, who again has recently passed away. So Rick came down and he had a look, and then they got Reading University involved, and they carbon dated. They took samples. We took them down on a terrible, terrible January day, like it was howling gale, and they were really sort of impressed with what they were seeing, and they were taking carbon samples of all these baskets, and they were, you know, lots like this urn shape, lots and lots, but there were others as well that were completely different, so older, and you look at them and some of them look like they were made yesterday.
Do you know how old they were?
Yeah, they were carbon dated till between the 11th and 15th century.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, the 11th and 15th century.
Isn't that exciting?
And Rick Turner did a paper on it, if you research it.
Really?
And for the Seven Levels Research Committee, I think it was at the time, and he done a paper on that find, and it was described as significant and all the rest of it. They were very impressive anyway.
So he was with Cadw?
He was with Cadw.
So I might find that there.
Yeah. But the Seven Levels Research Committee was one of these organisations they had up until around about that time.
They're
probably gone now. But it's, I think he done the paper in 2007, perhaps, you know. And 18 rings a bell as well. It might have been number 18 publication or something rather. I did have a copy of it, but I can't find it.
Wow, how fascinating.
So, that was that.
So you really are treading in the footsteps of your forebears, aren't you?
We feel that when we're out there, like, you know, and this, people have fished out there forever. I mean, you're in the footsteps of your ancestors, your forefathers, and, you know, to me, that's a big part of it, you know, and I feel it's a gift, really. And I think all that's happened over the last, you know, 20 years has been fate. If we hadn't have got the licences when we did, the fishing wouldn't have been here now.
Mm.
Without a doubt, it would have gone, and it'd be gone forever. And all the skills, the knowledge, and what harm does it do? It didn't do any harm. But, it, you know, and we've built this fishery now. Okay. You know, we've had to agree to restrictions, severe restrictions, really. But the new fishermen now don't know any different.
Mm.
So, and I'm realistic to know that you ain't going to get anything back. I mean, once he takes something, they ain't going to give it back. Natural Resources Wales or anybody else. But that said, we're quite happy. As long as they leave us alone and don't give us all the grief,
yeah.
then why should they? You know, we're doing no harm. Closing us down is not going to make a blimey of difference to salmon stock. Neither are the other fisheries that have been closed down proportionally. I mean, they've closed them all down. The problems lie on the rivers.
Yeah.
As soon as those salmon take a turn into the rivers, they're under so much pressure you wouldn't believe.
Well, but you can't possibly overfish anyway, can you?
No, it's impossible. You know? But you can't, because you cannot fish for 99.9% of the time.
Mm. And it's for me, you see, you know, when you go down the coast a bit, the footprints that they find, you know, these Stone Age footprints, the woman and her child, and that's celebrated, which is fantastic, fine, but I can't help, for me, you see, social historian, that you are really treading in the footsteps of your ancestors and keeping this alive.
We are, and you know, it's been recorded on the estuary in the 17th century, but it must predate that.
Must do.
But, you know, a lot of things are important to me, but, you know, preserving a way of life is important. And what they don't realise is, if I thought we were having any effect on salmon stocks, I would have stopped a long time ago. I'd have walked away. If we had been stringing a net across the mouth of the Wye, I'd have said, hang on, boys, we're going to sort of stop and think about this. But it's funny how things have happened. I mean, we're sort of, you know, we've got it out there. You know, people would, and people understand what we're trying to do. They see what we're trying to do. There are more, you know, there's more to be lost and to be gained than closing this fishery. You know, that's for sure. And even, you know, the powers, you know, some pretty powerful people in the rod sort of fishing sort of side of it, on the Wye, for instance. You know, they're quite sympathetic. You know, that's the vibe I get off them anyway, of what we're doing. Because another thing they can see is that there are no bailiffs anymore. You know, and I was reading your book about with George and everything, and, you know, I met him, you know, two or three times, you know, down here, again, when we were in the middle of a war with the Environment Agency. But are they naive enough to think that there are still not poachers on the estuary? Or if stock picked up a little bit, there wouldn't be more poachers on the estuary. I mean, it's, and you've got no people looking after the river, but part of what our fishing now, we spend so much time out here, not all of us, but three or four of us, that there's always a presence there and people see it. I mean, that guy I come down here just then, he's always down, he's one you've got to watch, like. You know, nice, he's alright, like, you know, but we know
you're looking after your patch,
which we're watching our patch, and that's important, and I think people with common sense see that as well. So it's just another thing. You know, if we're not here, you know, I know that if somebody starts staking nets out there, I'm going to know about it. And people around you that are thinking of doing it know that I'm around, or my brother, or two or three of the others are about. And we soon get to hear about it.
You're a caretaker, really, aren't you?
Yeah.
Until you hand it on to the next generation.
Exactly, yeah.
And have you got enough people coming through?
Well, that's another thing. When we started with, you know, I thought it was finished, really. I mean, it was just me and Bob and Rich. Den was fishing in the Guts. And my uncle, John, I mentioned the family, who was getting on a bit then. I suppose he must have been 70. All of a sudden, he took up a license.
Is he still alive?
He's in a nursing home at the moment. Is he? Yeah. So, but he was the eldest son of my great grandfather. You know, his grandfather was William Corbin. So he fished for 3 or 4 years. So he sort of came into the fishing then. And then he sort of packed it in, and then Denno packed it in, and it was back to me and Bob again. And I thought, oh, crikey. And then, out of the blue, Tim Bevan, again, I mentioned his name early on, a local boy, whose uncle had fished many years ago, he took up a license. And things were sort of being... You were seeing it on TV. TV companies were getting involved, yeah, and coming down to watch a fishing, and people writing, doing little books and, yeah, magazines. And it was people in the village were starting to take notice of the fishing, because, mm, a lot of them probably never heard of it before. Port Stewart has changed. I mean, it's huge compared to what it used to be. In,
so
in
many incomers.
Yeah, and, lots, yeah, of incomers. And then they were taking an interest. But Tim took my license, and then, of course, he's in the pub. And he's talking to somebody, and then a couple of other boys expressed an interest, and they took up licenses. And before you knew it, we had 7 or 8, the maximum, sort of fishermen.
Right.
And it's sort of a new lease of life. Mm. All of a sudden, when I started, I was the second youngest. I'm now the second oldest. So it's, you know, it's just quite
frightening.
That's
a bit sobering, isn't it?
It is very sobering. but it was so great, and it's brought a new lease of life to the fishery, and I really feel it's turned a corner. It, you know, it certainly has in that respect. And you know, you got, you know, boys suggesting Facebook pages, and you know, you might think, oh crikey, what's that about? But that's proved a marvellous thing.
It's I share your views on that. I'm like slightly, oh god, really? It's so much, you know, self-obsession, but with the river project, it's been a fantastic way of reaching people, as has your page.
I mean, it's really got it out there, but it's a frightening, they say drugs are addictive and booze is addictive, but it's an addictive thing.
You can
be dragged right into it. But for the page, it's been a great thing, and you know, long may it continue. But I mean, as far as, you couldn't be in a better place. We could not be in a better place. The only fly in the ointment at the moment is that we've managed to get our new 10-year lease. They did change it about, and God knows what they put in it. You know, we didn't really know at the end of the day, but we had to sign it to be able to fish. But the latest big idea of Natural Resources Wales is total catch and release for all salmon in Wales. That's the latest thing that was presented, I think, last year to the Minister for Rural Affairs, Leslie Griffiths, and she has put it up for a public inquiry.
So is she an angler at all, or a fisher?
I have no idea what she is. She's the Minister for Rural Affairs in the Welsh Assembly. So she has now ordered a public inquiry, which starts on the 15th of January. We've questioned whether we are sort of going to be, that restriction would be put on us, but you know, writing to these people is like clean your ear out. But we have got letters that sort of say that at the moment, at this time and all the rest of it, that it won't be, because the Wye is probably not at risk. And
why ask any help? Why ask foundation?
They would be well aware of what we're doing.
Yeah, but are there any help in...
I met Stephen Marsh Smith. I met the guy who took over from him. Again, they didn't seem to have any problem with what we're doing. You know, I don't know, but it's Natural Resources Wales and the people within it. Peter Goff, I mean, he goes back, you know, 20 years when we first started all this. He's been there ever since, and I think he's hell-bent. I think he's deluded. I think he's hell-bent on finishing us. I haven't looked at all the sort of stuff that they're going to say at this inquiry, but all these names keep popping up. The people from 20 years ago, Guy Morrill. God. If you read the evidence and all the rest of it on it, and...
I wonder if you need to press the heritage social history side a bit.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, because that's why I mentioned the footprints down the road there. You know, that they make a big deal of that.
It makes no difference, Marsha, with the Environment Agency, Natural Resources Wales. That they've, endless letters. Oh, you know, we push it with them, and they said, "Yeah, you can have your heritage. You know, great. You can go up there and fish anytime you like, but you put the fish back, or you can stand there with a hole cut in the back of your net, so the fish can swim through it." And you just think, what planet so these people are? You just want to pull your hair out. So we learned years ago. I learned straight away. You know, basically, I went to a meeting back. Oh, Christ, when was it? 2006, 2005, at the Elam Valley.
Yeah.
All sort of naive and sort of you're going to make a difference. Yeah. And you walk into this meeting, and all of a sudden these people come out to the woodwork, and you know the
big ones,
the big guns, yeah, like, and all the rest of it. And you're just thinking, well, you know, all the netsmen resigned anyway. They just said, no, we're not having any of this. Mm-hmm. You couldn't deal with them. You know, mm-hmm. it's frightening, really.
They talk each other's language, you see.
They do, and you just cannot compete. No, mm-hmm. I just thought, I can't compete.
No.
So I thought,
but I think you're doing the right thing by doing this, you know, social media, raising the profile, and you have had lots of profile.
Oh yeah,
on the television,
it's amazing, incredible. It's never been off TV in the last 20 years, and you name it, it's been on it. And you know, okay, you know, I wish I could compete in other ways, but you know you can't, so you just do what you can.
Yeah.
And I think right-minded people that, you know, sort of support us, and we locally, I mean, you never believe the support we get. I mean, we used to, when we built this net house, there's pictures there on the wall, 2006 I think it was, we had an open day for the fishery at the end of the season, and it was just family and friends, really. So we could, you know, 20 people, all the rest of it, and we had one last year, all these years later, and there was like 300 or more people there.
Well,
so, and the people from far and wide, the locality, and they all sort of support us, and it's brilliant.
Well, part of my remit is to organise a series of events. One is to let people know about the wider project, but it's volunteer recruitment as well. So would you be willing to come along to one of those and pay for your expenses and stuff, just to talk about what you do, maybe bring some of this along?
Yeah.
Because there's lots of new developments going up, and the question is, do they know about their locality, their heritage?
Mm.
And so is that something you might be
doing? Yeah, I mean, I could do stuff every day of the week, Ash. You know, but I don't mind doing it at all.
Mm.
But you know, unfortunately, I got to be absolutely a few bob. Like,
yeah,
you know,
course,
you know,
yeah.
What I'm saying, I'm not greedy at all. But
okay.
At all.
So, how much would you expect then?
For what?
If you're coming along to do talk a bit about the fishery.
What, for a day or for after?
It would be for an hour.
An hour.
Yeah. But it wouldn't be just an hour, would it? Because you've got to prepare, get your stuff there. So, is it half a day?
Half a day. I don't know. £50 plus your expenses, something like that. You know, I don't know.
Well, that's what I do for talks. When I do a talk for the river, I charge £50 plus expenses.
Yeah.
You know,
when I do a talk, you know, depending on where it is, you know, I charge £35-40 plus my expenses. Like, you know, it's, I don't know.
No, I think £50's fair enough, isn't it? You know, I know some people who do 100, but I don't know if I can charge 100 yet.
Well, you know, if I'm out for the day, I mean, it's generally somewhere around that. But it depends what I'm doing. I mean, depends who it is. Depends, you know, what money they got. You know.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm. Fancy a quick question about eels and elvers. Did you have people elver fishing?
No, it's elver. There are the licenses for elver fishing have been. I'm not sure whether they've been frozen or whether, you know, you can't get any more licenses. But there is some elver fishing locally, or there was.
Mm.
You can't. I'm not 100% sure if it's still happening, but certainly
there
a few years
though,
ago,
there,
no. And they fish on the pills. Caldicot pill, I've seen them fishing. Mega pill, I've seen them fishing. But it's not like it is up the rivers. I mean, it would be a small catch. It is quite frightening, really, because I've done a little film, actually, on the pills the other day. Just a little, when the wind is light, the camera I got, if there's any wind blowing, it's terrible, you can't hear what I'm saying. But anyway, when I was a kid, it made me think about the pills. Culliard Castle, right, the Neddon. When I was a kid, there's a bridge, a little road bridge, just by the next to the castle, and the Neddon Brook would run through there, and all the way down to the Severn Estuary. It was always crystal clear, okay? That's the Rhean, which the Elvers, talking about Elvers, are making their way into. You know, the brooks and the Rheans, you know, bordering the levels, or on the levels. And I would go, when was that? That would be the mid-70s?
Yeah.
Or perhaps early 70s. You'd be down there, skiving school, under the bridge, as such, or whatever, or playing, or messing about. And you would be able to catch sticklebacks and newts. It was crystal clear and full of fish. And we went down there last year, or a few years back, and last year, and it's black.
Really?
Black and full of just shit, you know, sewage, you know, sort of, I don't know if it's sewage, but it's just not what it was. So these elvers, I think, in lots of places, are coming through from the estuary, through the sluice gates. Another thing, I'm not 100% sure about these sluice gates either, because I'm not quite sure, I don't think they used to be there or in the same shape and form. You know, whether they can actually get through the sea defences, through these sluice gates. But anyway, when they actually get into some of these rains, the rains are filthy. You know, they're not what they used to be. So habitat, I think, has been destroyed.
So when you were a kid, you used to play on the rains, did you?
Oh, yeah. We used to go up to, on the levels, at the furthest one we used to go to is Saint-Pierre Pill.
Yeah.
There's a rain, there's rains behind there. And it would be full of fish. Full of fish, tadpoles, a lot of them haven't been dredged out. That's another thing they do on these rains. You know, they're constantly raking them out. And I'm not sure in some cases that it is a good idea in disturbing sort of nature. You know, I don't know. I don't know if they've got the management of these things right. I'm no expert on it at all, but I sometimes do wonder. But, you know, the one example I can state is the one at the Neddon Brook, and that is not what it used to be by a long, long chalk.
It's a heavy industry around there.
No, no, I think it could be housing there. I think they did do some sort of study in the Environment Agency regarding the pollution that's going into that particular rain, and they put it down to bad plumbing on housing and stuff, you know, and God knows what. But it is just an example of how things have changed over the years. It's, you know, you used to get all sorts in the rains, sort of eels. Bigger eels, and you don't see that anymore. They look dead to me, to be honest. I spend a lot of time on the levels. You know, we cut a willow for the nets on the levels.
Where?
Just on the Calicut levels, out of pollarded trees. The reams have always been made from willow, cut that in the winter. Need a ladder to get up the tree now, but but you cut it in the winter, strip the bark off, and
so you source everything locally?
Yeah, everything that's made, the frame of the laid net is, and the main thing is the willow. I mean, because you've got the pollarded trees down the levels, that sort of curve that comes out the top of the tree after about 2 years, that's what you're looking for, that little curve, about 2 inches in diameter. You watch the tree grow, and then get up there and chop a couple out. As far as the handle, the rock staff goes, it's not on the levels but behind the levels. Slade wood perhaps is a good place. Ash, you get an ash sapling growing, and what happens is that you get this one there, much harder than
solid,
the
wall,
obviously. And you're going to have ash sapling growing just like that, and you have two shoots on it, and that one becomes dominant, that one falls off, and you see that, and you're looking for that kick that's produced when that comes away, and that's common in ash saplings, and you cut that again, in January, February. The sap is down. Strip the back off straight away, and that's your handle, and what we call the rock staff, because that's the traditional shape. And ash is very hard, and the handle of the net is not only used for a handle, it's used for a walking stick, a feeler, as the name
when
rock staff involved. Yeah, when you're wading, sort of out there, and use this to feel, you know roughly what's under the water in front of you, but you're sort of feeling for holes and gullies, and if you feel a hole or gully, you just move to the one side. Also, the tie can be running on your body at 5 or 6 knots, and you've got a job to stand up sometimes, and you use this for balance.
Why?
Sort of, you know, to help yourself stay upright, or if you trip, put it down and sort of stop yourself falling on your face. As such.
Well, I'm going to just check the time. I'm going to have to go. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Martin? Any other memories or characters or stuff?
Oh, crikey. I don't
know. Probably all come to you after I've gone.
Yeah, I know it will, yeah, definitely.
You can always add it when I've done the transcription. I'll bring that back. Yeah. You can add things to it.
Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah.
But I'd love to come out one day. Would that be possible?
Come out in the pick. The trick is to pick a big spring tide on a very calm day. So watch the weather, and lighter winds are better.
That means absolutely nothing to me.
Yeah, they'll phone me up then. Just message me.
Like, I will never clue what a light wind is.
We're best off coming out on the in that situation, because we could you go up in the boat then, you go up mid-channel, or even walk it if you wanted to.
Yeah.
We take you across onto the island and
leave me. Oh my god.
Charge you to come back.
Oh my goodness. You're too young to remember the Aust Ferry then, aren't you?
Yeah. I may have been across it taken across on it.
And are you okay for me to give your contact to Emma Drabble? She's a photographer.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, it's fine. I
imagine she'd like to take some in here and probably out there as well.
Yeah, no problem. I'm sure. No problem.
Thanks, Martin. Can I take a photograph just for the Facebook page?
Yeah, you can, yeah. I'll take one of you as well.
Oh, God. Well, I've got to show you a photograph yesterday. God, I've still got a toothache. It's horrible. Big bloody thing. Oh, no, it's not on here. It's on here. Here.
What's that, a pike, is it?
Is it a
pike? Oh, a bit fishing.
Well, I went with George and Martin Bowler.
Oh, right, yeah.
Do you know Martin Bowler?
No, I don't know.
He writes the Angling Times.
Oh, right, never to go.
Yeah, and actually, I didn't really do anything, I just held a very rod, actually.
I think I have a picture of you on the net, actually, as well.
Oh, should I keep the hat on or off? Let me just...
Do you like it?
Well, maybe could you just move that side just a slightly bit? Because just a slightly. It's a great shed, you know. I'll just take them down.
I can't really see it with my glasses, but there.
Right here. Actually, can I have you standing there? Sorry, I'm just going to move my rubbish, actually, get that out of the way. quite nice. Oh, yeah, that's much better. Sorry.
You can do what you like.
I have my photograph taken. Oh, no, that's better. You can see inside your lovely shed there. All the legs are your book.
Yeah.
Right then.
We get one for Richard as well.
Yeah, got one in the car. Let me go and grab one for you. Do you want to put it to you, Martin?
Yeah, you can put it whatever you like.
Is it T-I-N or T-Y?
Coracles.
Yeah, did they? Were they ever used on the?
It's too out here. It'd be too.